This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We haven't talked lately with Chuck Hughes, who's the executive director of the Gary Chamber of Commerce, about some of the events that happen in the community and the business prospects and the like. But there's one program that you'll want to know about. It's a virtual conversation that is going to be happening tomorrow, Friday, June 12th at 2:30 in the afternoon. That is one that's being hosted by Senator Todd Young. And you, if you're involved in Northwest Indiana and interested in some of the issues, should find out about. And Chuck, thank you for joining us first on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this program coming up, this virtual conversation with Senator Todd Young on Friday.
It's pretty much in keeping what we've done at the Gary Chamber of Commerce. We pride ourselves on trying to seek solutions, and we're not political, but we go across the aisle. As you can recall, we were the first and only chamber to host Mitch Daniels when he was the governor of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
We hosted Vice President Mike Pence exactly about 30 days after he first took office, when he wanted to promote his HIP 2.0 program. And then we hosted him again maybe 60 days or so before he was selected to be the vice president. And so with Senator Young being a GOP senator, we just think it's important to not only connect with our legislators who are in our predominantly Democratic area, but certainly reach across the aisle and try to engage conversation and ultimately, hopefully, support mm-hmm. from both sides of the aisle, because it's, as the cliche goes, it's going to take all of us now in order to get out of this malaise that we're in right now.
One of the things I know that the Chamber likes to cover is to get good input from not only local and area business owners and community leaders and citizens, but also from the politicians about these issues. And I'm sure that Senator Young is going to have a lot to talk about from his vantage point on Capitol Hill, talking about the issues like the coronavirus and some of the other issues which have cropped up lately with the police and community relations and things like that, the racial inequity that is out there. I'm sure he'll have a lot to say. Maybe he'll give us some insight on some of the things that they're talking about in Washington.
Hey, Chris, I'm going to give you a little insight here, a little scoop.
Okay.
Here's probably a few of the topic areas we're going to discuss off the bat. But, of course, time permitting, we'll expand it to cover any of the issues and concerns that we want to present to our legislative representative. But some of the topics obviously are going to involve the coronavirus and its effect and the response of the business community and the challenges with reopening the economy and those kinds of things. And we're going to talk in general about business in cities like Gary, how they're going to be able to reopen and sustain itself when there were challenges even prior to this pandemic taking place. And we're going to touch lightly upon the murder of George Floyd. And that's pretty much the fundamental agenda that was provided mm-hmm. by Senator Young's office. Even the talk about George Floyd, that came from Senator Young's office. I can give you some idea of what the run of show is going to look like.
Okay. Well,
it's going to start at 2:30.
Okay.
And so we say about 5 minutes, we're going to give Senator Young an opportunity to welcome the participants, introduce his staff, about 5 minutes or so of that. And then, let's say from 2:30 to about 2:40, I will be making opening comments, and I'll introduce chamber member participants that we'll have sort of as a virtual panel. And then about 2:40, Senator Young will be making his brief opening remarks, whatever his remarks may be. And then at about 2:45, I guess, I will be moderating, so I'll lead a discussion with Senator Young and the chamber members. Now, on our panel, we have gentleman from City of Gary. I think it's a gentleman. Well, let me put it this way. We have a person from the City of Gary. I haven't met the person. The name is Hanifa Khalik.
Mm-hmm.
That person is the Director of Human Relations and the city's ADA and Title VI Coordinator for the city. The only reason the mayor is not there is that he has a procedure that he has to attend to that day. But this this person will be representing the city of Gary. And then we're gonna look at education as part of the focus too. So a young lady by the name of Kim Bradley, representing Paige McNulty, who is the interim chief academic officer, excuse me, and the director of federal programs for the Gary Community School Corporation. We will also have Dr. Danita Johnson Hughes, who is the president and CEO of Edgewater Health. And then representing the chamber, we will have Eric Allen. He's the co-chair of the chamber's Commerce, Economic Development, and Business Development Committee. So we've kind of got a broad base of people who are on that particular panel. We will address those issues, but of course, there will be time afterwards for us to touch upon anything that's affecting anybody and other comments. So that's pretty much the way it's we've got it designed to work out.
Now, this virtual conversation that you all will have with Senator Todd Young is going to be on Zoom. If anybody is interested in participating and finding out more about this, how do they be able to link up with the conversation tomorrow?
Yeah, I knew you'd ask that question, because when I get off the phone, I'm going to be back with Senator Young's office, because they're setting it up, but they haven't given me the information yet. And so as soon as I get it, we're going to, you know, email and send it out and notify the media, of course, and let you know. So okay. I would expect to have that information sometime today.
That's good. Well, we'll have it in the newscast. If not today, we'll make mention of, course, tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll make sure that you have it.
In plenty of time
for the media first.
Yeah, in plenty of time for the 2:30 session tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely. So,
in talking about some of these issues, we talk about economic issues a lot. I know, Chuck, and the Gary Chamber of Commerce was working on a number of things, I know, and helping to improve the lot for residents and businesses in the city of Gary. And then, of course, the coronavirus popped in to kind of steal the spotlight and the like. But if things work out better, certainly later this year, are we liable to see more improvements economically, more businesses and industries either expand or come into Gary anytime soon?
We do. In fact, there was a lot of conversation taking place. I do want to say that early on, I had a conversation with Mayor Jerome Prince, and I've been very impressed with the fact that he has a keen sense and awareness of how important it is to build the business community in Gary. He knows how important it is to the tax base and to try to get the resources in to help with public safety, cleaning up the city, helping salaries with the employees, those kinds of. So he has a very keen sense of what it takes, and he's agreed to work very closely with the chamber. I mean, we are exclusively the business, essentially the organization in the city whose function is exclusively trying to promote business, attract business, keep businesses here. And so that's a very good start, to know that we will be lockstep with the administration and trying to make some good things happen. I've also had conversations, and I won't name them right away, but with a couple of other not-for-profit agencies that want to do some things to help support the business community, and we hope that that can take place. I mean, even conceivably in the vein of some small grants or some things like that, the chamber, we're going to help promote, encourage, entice, try to maintain, retain, attract businesses in the community. The chamber and the mayor, we've had conversations with potential investors,
that's good,
both nationally and internationally. Mm-hmm. And so it's encouraging that we've had those conversations. To your point, the virus has clearly put a halt to some things. I mean, because even some of the potential folks who want to come in here and do something, their travel restrictions, their logistical problems, even in their cities and countries and such or whatever. But, you know, from the old adage that the glass is half full, we're very positive that some good things could happen. We just have to accede to the wishes of Mr. COVID-19.
That's true. We're talking with Chuck Hughes, who's the executive director of the Gary Chamber of Commerce, about some of the issues that businesses and industries in Gary, also the government as well, too, face. And I know, Chuck, that we went into this year with a number of improvements in the city of Gary and projects that have gotten started. We know for a fact, of course, that the Amazon warehouse is all set up. They've been working very closely with the headquarters and getting another way to get packages and the like moving through Northwest Indiana out of Gary. And I know that there have been a couple environmental projects in particular that have been at least talked about, if not gotten underway. Some projects that that in turn will mean more jobs and more business opportunities in Gary. Are we still pretty much on track in a lot of these things? And how are these projects that I've kind of mentioned here, how are they doing as far as you know?
Well, as far as I know, all of those things are still taking place. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it. When you talk about restarting and jump-starting the economy, it has to begin where you left off. And so those things were viable then, and they're probably more viable now. You know that I believe it's Amazon who just signed a deal with the airport. We've got some good things going, and there's some other possibilities that I hear about. I'm not one to speculate, and I'm not one to preempt any announcements that are not have been concrete or solidified. Or certainly, I'm not going to usurp the opportunity for the mayor, mm-hmm. you know, to make his presentations or whatever. But I do think that there's some very, very progressive things that are going to occur in this city. You know, I think there's been a evaluation of Gary. I mean, it's something that people have already known, but what happens a lot of times, and it don't have to necessarily be a pandemic, but it could be any kind of calamity. Adversity brings people together. I mean, this pandemic has crippled everybody, and now we see the virtue of trying to restore Northwest Indiana in its totality. But of course, if you develop the Gary Airport, then look at the residual benefits that the entire region receives. If we do things around the lakefront, look at particularly with people who've been sequestered and locked down in their homes and such or whatever. I mean, people are crying out for the ability to get out and enjoy life and enjoy resources that are available. And Gary has a wealth of those things. And so I think people are starting to recognize those things. There's been movement about tearing down abandoned schools and selling the buildings, and people have been eager. They've been placing offers mm-hmm. and trying to do those things. That's why we have an education component there, because it's not a matter of us just wanting to get rid of the buildings or having them torn down or someone taking them over. We're looking at everything is focused on economic development.
Right.
We're looking at economic development in this community, and so maybe this pandemic was a proverbial kick in the derriere mm-hmm. For us to really maybe try to fast track some of these things that have been bandied about and speculated upon. So I am an optimist.
Well, and as you're speaking about the abandoned school buildings that the Gary Community Schools are trying to handle, and the city of Gary too, because a lot of it, I know that the mayor's office and his staff are trying to work on and coordinate this. Are some of these places that you're aware of that are available, that they have been schools before, but there are still really really good potential business sites that are out there that just have to be obtained and reworked? To make them,
oh, there's
make
no,
them work,
there's no question.
Yeah.
I can give you one
okay.
off the top of my head. That's the old site of the Wirt High School.
Mm-hmm.
That's located on Grand Boulevard. It's probably, as far as I know, in the best condition of any of the abandoned buildings. And you know, Miller is the the preeminent district in the city of Gary, and it's a stone's throw from the lake. And so there's an enormous amount of potential there. Some of the other schools may be strategically located in the footprint of Indiana University and places like that, that we're looking towards expansion as such or whatever. So if you look at the site map of these buildings, some may just need to be torn down and forever removed, and others there is potential growth in areas where the city and developers are eyeing development as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good news to know that even though that we have COVID-19, that's, like you say, kind of put everything on hold, at least as far as real expansion is concerned, that the ideas are still there. And once things get back to the, even into the new normal, as it seems it's going to be, we'll still be able to do a lot of things to help make improvements in the city of Gary. And Chuck, thank you for spending time to going over these things. And we're looking forward to this virtual conversation on Friday afternoon at 2:30 with Senator Todd Young, the conversation that'll be on Zoom, and watch for more information as to how you can participate in that too. And thank you for spending time with us to go over the economic issues in the city of Gary and some of the political ones too with Senator Young's conversation tomorrow.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Appreciate the great job that you're doing sharing news in Northwest Indiana. And we're certainly available anytime that you need us. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, you're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Certainly. And that's what we're here for. Chuck Hughes is the Executive Director of the Gary Chamber of Commerce. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The world's first study of an antibody treatment against COVID-19 has roots right here in Indiana. Indianapolis-based Eli Lilly and Company started an early-stage human trial to test its potential treatment for the virus. Lilly's chairman and CEO Dave Ricks discusses the study and when it could become available with Inside Indiana Business host Gary Dick. Here's the conversation.
Hello and welcome to Inside Indiana Business. I'm Gary Dick. Eli Lilly and Company has begun giving patients antibody treatments in the world's first study of a potential treatment designed to fight COVID-19. Now, Lilly says the investigational medicine is the first potential new medicine designed specifically to target the virus that caused COVID-19. Lilly CEO Dave Ricks joins us now with more on the study and what could come next. And Dave, as always, welcome to the program.
Great to be back. Thank you, Gary.
Let's talk about this. I mentioned a moment ago your company, Lilly, making global headlines. This is the world's first study of an antibody treatment against the disease. Previously, all of the other treatments have been really repurposed from other diseases. Talk about the significance of this study and why you're aggressively pursuing it.
Yeah, thank you. We're very excited. I'm so proud of our scientists who have worked at really record speed in the early days of the pandemic, identifying a partner, a Canadian company called AbCellera, that helped us identify this antibody, which is a protein that your body makes to fight disease. We isolated this one from actually a surviving patient, and then we make it in industrial scale, where we began testing. We announced that we began testing on Monday, and we could have data coming in just a few weeks' time that could show it's effective. If so, we've already begun the motions to produce it at quantity, because we know everyone's concerned about the risk of COVID-19, particularly for hospitalized patients in the fall. And we're poised to be ready to do that, and proud of Lilly being the first in the world to test COVID-specific new medicine.
Yeah, will be very interesting to watch that develop. You mentioned the partnership with the Canadian company and doing that early on and in really breakneck speed, if you will. You hopped on the coronavirus, the pandemic early on, in part based on what you were seeing some of your global operations.
Correct. Yeah, as a global company, you know, we operate large scale operations in China. So we had seen that at the end of January, early February. It then moved to Europe, happened to be in places where Lilly has large facilities as well, France, Madrid, and Italy. And so it wasn't too difficult to determine at that point that this was going to be a major issue in the U.S. and we better get to work on business continuity plans. We need to make the essential life-saving medicines like insulin that we make here in Indiana, and make preparations to be have strong business continuity during the pandemic. We sent our people home early. I know that got some news locally, but we're glad we did it. And we're bringing people back slowly to protect human health, but also the people who need to come to work to make medicine and run our laboratories.
Yeah, you early on, you also partnered with the state and others on testing. And I know that testing, as we were talking off camera a moment ago, is going to another phase that will have some developments that we'll see perhaps as early as this summer.
That's right, yeah. So Lilly really has been a key backstop to the Indiana State Department of Health during the pandemic, perhaps doing 30 to 40% of the tests in the state so far. A reminder, we're not a testing company. We repurposed a laboratory to support this. We'd like to use that laboratory again to support clinical trials and other things we do. And I think it's good for the state to install a permanent and regionalized capacity to test. When I talk to other employers, what they want to know is, can my workers, if they feel sick, get tested and a result back in 24 hours? So we need sites in South Bend, in Fort Wayne, in Evansville. And that's what we're working with the state on, is to replicate our laboratory in those places.
Dave, as you look at the impact that the pandemic has had on Lilly and will have for the remainder of the year, give us some sense in terms of the impact on the business.
Yeah, well, we had a very strong Q1 in part because there was some forward buying. We've said that will wash out a bit on the balance of the year, but we kept our guidance for the year. I guess, fortunately, you know, we're in the health business, and that's typically less cyclical with economic turns. No doubt many businesses are struggling, and it will be a difficult second half of the year for the country. Now, we feel great about our prospects because we make products people really need, but also we've been so successful at launching new medicines. And Gary, it's important to point out the FDA has actually approved two medicines since we've been in the pandemic, which is really remarkable, a new cancer medicine and an Alzheimer's tracing medicine, so as well as new indications. So our business goes on. The innovation engine at Lilly is in great shape, and that needs to continue to grow the company, and that's what we're focused on for the long term.
A lot going on at one of Indiana's marquee companies, Eli Lilly and Company. Dave Ricks, the CEO at Lilly. As always, thank you, Dave, for joining us. Be safe, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, I hope to see you soon. Take care.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Times reporter Joseph Pete has been quite busy covering the latest in business news, as well as hosting some book signings across the region. He joined us back in early April. That was right before the release of his book entitled Lost Hammond, to talk about the book that focuses on the lost history of Hammond, the city's rich history in industries like steel mills and oil refineries and ports, as well as a look as to how it earned the title Atlantic City on the Lake. And, of course, no book about the rich history of Hammond would be complete without a nod to native son Gene Shepherd's A Christmas Story. Here's the original conversation. Joseph Pete is a writer and a journalist. We talk to him often, of course, in his capacity as the business reporter and writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana. But he's also an author of books and of other scholarly works as well. And this latest book that is out that you can actually get a copy of involves the lost history, of the city of Hammond, Indiana. In fact, it's entitled Lost Hammond, Indiana. It's published by Arcadia Publishing and the History Press. Joseph Pete, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today in a capacity other than talking about your stories.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
This is an interesting book, and for somebody who enjoys nonfiction, and especially for a history buff, for Northwest Indiana history in particular, this is one that you'll want to pick up and read all the way through. And it starts out, and I know it's interesting, I want to go to the very end and mention something at the end, and we can go into that here. But in particular, I want to go into some more of the particulars of the book. But you mentioned at the very end of the book, in fact, some of the last words of the book state that Hammond is a city that checks in, talking about the fact it's a working-class city by nature and by its origin, and it's a city that has not checked out, which I guess is very good and very appropriate for the economic outturn that we are going through these days. But first, let's start with the history of Hammond. How did the city of Hammond become the city of Hammond? Because I know it's really linked to the railroads and to the slaughterhouses, isn't it?
The main development of Hammond occurred because of the slaughterhouse industry in Chicago, and it was kind of full up on the south side, and it ended up kind of spilling across the state line. And it had pretty much been, like most of Northwest Indiana was the last part of the state to be settled because it was so inhospitable with the cold winters off of Lake Michigan. And originally a lot of the land here was marshland, and it was not suitable for, you know, farming. So we were one of the last areas in the state to actually be developed, and a lot of our development occurred because the industry was built in Chicago, and it was built on the south side. So the effluent and everything at the time, you know, they just dumped everything into rivers, and they, you know, didn't want it. That typically you'd have a lot of the industry in a lot of cities on the south side, so it doesn't flow through the rest of town. And they ended up, slaughterhouse industry was, of course, built on the south side. There was a giant slaughterhouse that was built by George Hammond, who was an industrialist in Detroit. He was actually one of the founders of the Detroit Institute of Arts, if you've ever been to that fine facility. Mm-hmm. But he was kind of a big... a big industrial magnate in the Motor City, and he ended up building a slaughterhouse in Hammond, which originally was the first major permanent settlement. And it was because the railroads were kind of going through town, and they would he came up with the innovation of refrigerated rail cars. So they would take, meat from all over the Midwest and, beef and everything else and process it. And then they would ship it mainly originally to the East Coast, like to Boston and New England. And the refrigerated cars would keep it in pretty, fresh condition until it arrived. And the city kind of, grew from there. But it was so tied to the industry. Hammond was first known as State Line Slaughterhouse. That was the first name of the city. And it... and eventually other industries kind of came to town, and it kind of developed into, the industrial city we know today.
What time of history did we note that that the G.H. Hammond Meat Company actually became a very big enterprise in what is to become the city of Hammond? What years are we talking about primarily?
Oh, it was in the late 19th century. It started around 1869 when they first built the beef packaging plant, and it was pretty huge operation. It was literally producing hundreds of thousands of cattle, sheep, and pigs per year and sending them across the country. It pretty much persisted through most of the 19th century and into the early 20th century when the plant eventually burned down. And you hear all these stories about the Great Chicago Fire and everything, and it's very dramatized. But actually, I believe it was the Grand Calumet River also caught on fire. It was not that uncommon at the time. And it was because all the animal fat from the plant, when the plant was burning down, all the animal fat kind of slicked onto the river and caused the Grand Cal to catch on fire as well. So it was... The city's fortunes were originally entirely tied to it, but eventually you had the W.B. Conkey bookbinding plant and some other very large operations came, so it wasn't just a one industry town.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask in particular about here. You mentioned about the W.B. Conkey facility. It started out, basically is just as a bookbindery, but it became a very, very big printing concern, and probably rivaled Donnelley in Chicago, didn't it, for all the books and publications it put out.
Oh, absolutely. It was absolutely massive. It was many of the books read around the country were manufactured right in Hammond. They produced Bibles and the magazines and the copies of speeches were popular at the time, including the William Jennings Bryan Cross of Gold speech. There was they put out the Sears Roebuck catalog, dictionaries, encyclopedias. They put out all manner of books, and it was one of the city's biggest employers for a long time. And they produced books basically for the entire nation. It was a massive operation. It changed ownership a few times, but it was they produced all manner of books and magazines, and I think the Sears catalog was one of their big, because Sears was right by neighboring Chicago. Was one of their big cattle or cash cows, and how they kind of grew into the size that they did.
You mentioned in the book too about the link to Sears and Roebuck.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a little known thing that the book kind of focuses it. I was so fascinated by a lot of the tidbits in history that I came across while researching this. Mm-hmm. But Alva Roebuck, who was the founding partner of Sears, along with Sears, he spent most of his youth actually in Hammond. He was from Lafayette originally, but he went to Hammond to work as a watchmaker, and he was kind of involved in this romantic triangle where he was trying to court a local woman. Oh, it was a teacher, I think, at one of the local schools, and they were both kind of vying for his attention, and he ended up being slighted, and he was heartbroken and everything. So he then started to look to get out of town, and he saw an ad in one of the Chicago newspapers that Richard Sears was looking, who was originally from Minneapolis, and he was looking for, a watchmaker for his new shop in the Loop on Dearborn, and, needs somebody to fix watches. And he's just like, all right, well, I'm done with, my heart's broken. I'm done with this. I'm going to venture out and go on this new opportunity. And, of course, the rest was history, because it grew into one of the largest retailers of all time. And certainly the Sears was the retailer that defined the 20th century in America. Originally with the mail order catalogs, it was almost Amazon before the internet, and it kind of brought the world to all these rural farmers, scattered across the nation, where they had access to higher quality goods that otherwise wouldn't have been available. And then it kind of during the Eisenhower era and everything with the interstates and suburbanization. It built all these, you know, department stores all over. It filled the malls. It was one of the most ubiquitous and wide acres that you'd see in shopping malls. And it was just to more than many other companies, you know, Sears kind of ended up helping define, you know, life in the 20th century. And he spent a lot of his, one of the founders spent a lot of his formative years right in Hammond.
That's interesting to note because, you know, you wouldn't think that much about the origin of Sears and Roebuck, but of course it is very much tied to obviously Chicago, but to a little bit to Northwest Indiana. We're talking with Joseph Peet. He is the author of a new book, which is entitled Lost Hammond, Indiana. It's published by Arcadia Publishing and the History Press. And some of the other topics that you bring up in more detail in the book, Joe, is one dealing not only about business and industry, but about amusement, entertainment, and the like. And maybe people who live in Hammond will recognize this. If they are from Hammond, they definitely will. We're talking about the Five Points area, because that's more than just an intersection of streets. It was a whole amusement area for many, many years, I understand.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, in the early days of the city, like now you drive by there, you know, there's the casino, so there still is a lot of, there still is entertainment, but it was, you know, now it's largely kind of industrial area. It is right by the city of Chicago, but you have, you know, the Unilever plant, the Cargill plant, the Purple Steer Diner is pretty popular, but it's, you know, an area people pass through, either they're going to the casino or going to work or driving into the city, but it was a real destination back in the day. They had quite a bit of attractions there. There were a lot of, you know, the perch palaces like Phil Smith's and Vogel's Restaurant, and a lot of those, you know, beloved restaurants that kind of built Hammond's reputation. Because originally you didn't have the Borman, and that was kind of the main highway that Chicago residents would take when they were going through to go vacation, like somewhere in Indiana or beyond. Like they would, you know, pass through there. So there are a lot of like roadside attractions, but it was a big draw for everyone in town. Like they had, there was originally an interurban line, and there were trolleys that would kind of go out there, but they there's like a boardwalk park, there were you know, Ferris wheels, water chutes, there was roller coasters, there was a Hammond Beach Inn where, you know, you had these giant Madura's Dance Land, you had all these giant like dance halls, ice skating. It was like really the place where people would go for you know, for entertainment back in the day. One of the most amusing stories in the book that I was concerning that section, because they had opened the Athy Hydro Amusement Park, where it was, you know, by Wolf Lake at Indianapolis Boulevard, and they had put in the water had attracted all these mosquitoes, and it was kind of driving away the guests and everything. So The entrepreneur who was behind it, he ended up going to the Whiting Refinery and getting a gallon of gasoline and just dumping it right in the lake to you know, keep the mosquitoes away. But his venture ultimately, you know, failed. And but it was just interesting at the time. There was like no environmental consciousness or anything of that nature.
Well, it sounds like it was something that, you know, it's part of entrepreneurship in Hammond that people don't realize, that a lot of very forward-thinking people back in the 1800s and into the early 1900s are the ones that really made Hammond what it is even today, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, the city was kind of built with a lot of these large industrialists. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see a lot of the names, but this book gets into, if you ever drive around the city and you wonder about Hobart or Sibley or any of those, you know, big street names, this story really gets, or this book really gets into kind of the history of who those people are and how they built up the city and how they built a lot of its institutions and how it kind of came into its, you know, grew into its current its current state is the largest, you know, city in Northwest Indiana.
Well, that kind of gets us logically into downtown Hammond, or what people now know it more as a beautiful historic downtown Hammond, and the department stores that people recognize names and at least the recreation of names. We're talking, of course, about the EC Minus and Company and Goldblatt's, the big department stores that used to be in downtown Hammond. Its recreation, thanks to Gene Shepherd, is what makes it famous now.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, the A Christmas Story, that was the Goldblatt. He was immortalizing it, A Christmas Story.
Oh.
But the book gets into kind of how habit shaped today to said Gene Shepherd, who wrote one of the most enduring Christmas classics of all time, A Christmas Story, and how he was inspired by various habit landmarks, including the Goldblatt's department store, where, you know, the famous scene in the movie is going up to Santa about it, and it's actually Gene Shepherd himself in the movie who plays Santa, and he kicks young Ralphie down the slide, telling him, when he tells him he wants the Red Ryder BB gun, you know, like everyone else, it's the constant refrain of, you'll shoot your eye out, kid. But it's one of the most beloved lines from that movie. But it gets into the history of Goldblatt's and a history of E.C. Midas. At a lot of these places, like, you know, Habit used to be one of the biggest shopping destinations back before the malls, before you had South Lake and Woodbar and River Oaks and all those places. People shopped in downtown Habit and downtown Gary were the places where people went. And you had these grand department stores where they had pretty much everything. And it's just the way we lived nationally, not just in Northwest Indiana, kind of changed. And you saw all this suburbanization and sprawl. And, you know, you didn't really have the trains or the jitneys going to downtown anymore. And it lost focus on the urban core. But, the legacy of these places kind of endures. Like, one of the interesting through lines the book traces is that everybody's probably been to the South Shore Arts, you know, gallery in Munster. They have galleries in Hammond, Munster, Crown Point. They're all over. But they have that famous, like, bowling hat, like, Ike logo that you see that they've incorporated. And it's back because they originated that organization, that one of the biggest arts groups in Northwest Indiana, got its start because E.C. Midas had started hosting, like, an art salon show annually. It had been hosted somewhere in Chicago, one of the department stores in Chicago originally. It got canceled. E.C. Midas in downtown Hammond took it over, and then they had this annual arts expo for years featuring the work of, like, local artists from Northwest Indiana and beyond. And it was because it was run by their hat department, I think. So that's why you see that hat logo and anything affiliated with the South Shore Arts today.
That's wonderful. Let me bring up a couple more points, Joe, that are in the book Lost Hammond, Indiana, that people may or may not recognize. And certainly if you go into, we'll say, South Hammond, you see the last vestiges, first off, of Woodmar Mall. And that was a very unique institution in its own right, and one of the very first in the country, I understand.
Oh, yes. It was designed by the Austrian architect Victor Gruen, who was one of the most influential mall design architects, like, nationally. He helped kind of popularize the form. It was one of the first ones he had built, along with, I think, like, Georgia, New Jersey. I don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
But it was one of the first early ones, and it wasn't kind of finished. That's why you had, it was originally an open-air mall, and it was later enclosed. But because it was one of the earlier prototypes, that's why you had things like hallways that didn't lead to anywhere instead of, like, you know, looping back around or leading to an exit. It was one of the earliest examples of design. But it evolved and grew. It was obviously recently torn down. The Carson's was the last remaining. They had that three-story Carson's department store that was torn down to make way for the Hammond Sportsplex. But, it was an enduring fixture of, it helped, like, change Hammond a lot, too, because originally the downtown was kind of the focal point. You had these grand movie palaces, you had the department stores, you had a lot of the restaurants. Like, a lot of the life was focused around the downtown area, and they built a shopping mall, and that kind of, you know, became one of the main focal points for shopping and recreation and everything. And it kind of shifted a lot of the commercial activity to that area, to the Woodmar and, you know, south area. But it ended up, you know, of course, they built shopping malls further south, and, you know, a lot of suburbanization. People moved out of the city altogether, even to, you know, the Tri-Town or areas like that. And it ended up, kind of a victim of its own success in a way. But Victor Gurin, interestingly, he grew to hate shopping malls, like, later in his life, and allegedly before he had died, he said that he wished that every shopping mall in America would be torn down, and at least in Hammond, he kind of got his wish.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, if he'd lived long enough, he would have been able to certainly have seen that, to be sure. Well, Joseph, let me finally ask you about one other point. It's about transportation. You mentioned earlier in our conversation, of course, about the fact that the Borman Expressway kind of developed over time. But city streets and state highways and even U.S. highways that ran through Hammond kind of led to eventually the creation of the interstate system. But there is one, unfortunately, one standing, transportation monument is no longer there. And we have to talk about that, and you spent time in the book to mention it as well, about what is referred to affectionately and maybe not so affectionately by some as the Nine Span Bridge. Tell us more about the bridge, because there's nothing left. It's just a big concrete overpass, it seems, in that particular area now.
Yes, sadly, that's one thing I missed from my childhood. It was quite a landmark in Northwest Indiana. It was the bridge that connected Hammond and East Chicago on over the massive rail yard, where it was, a very iconic-looking steel bridge. I had actually kind of hoped I might be able to find some good photos to use it for the cover, but it turned out there wasn't anything available at the, Calumet Regional Archives or the Hammond Library or anything that was in high enough resolution. But it was a big icon. It was a very distinctive steel truss bridge. It was the longest bridge in Indiana that did not span water. I believe Archibald McKinley, a famous historian who I quote often in this work, he had wrote a column for the Times for many years. He described it as the longest viaduct over dry land in the world. But it was just an iconic, symbol of the city and of its industry. And it ended up, eventually it got the support beams kind of rusted away and it kind of deteriorated over time. And then NDOT, ended up tearing it down and putting in a new bridge. But the new bridge is just more, it doesn't anywhere near as aesthetic. It's just a functional concrete bridge. You can't even really see over. As you're driving, the barriers kind of even prevent you from looking out over the rail yard these days. You don't even have the epic view you used to have, but it was once a very dramatic, you could see pretty far and wide over the rail yard when you're driving over there previously. And from other directions, it was just visually striking, a beautiful historic bridge. And now it's now it's just kind of sadly was replaced by a more generic bridge. And that's kind of one of the reasons I wrote the book too, was because a lot of the history has been lost in Northwest Indiana, sadly. And you had a lot of grand structures back in the day, and they've either deteriorated or been torn down or just kind of been lost to the history. And then not a lot of their replacements or whatever haven't necessarily been as grand or landmark structures as, what was before. So I've just always felt it was very important. We've got a rich history in this area. We've got a very, we're an industrial powerhouse. We have contributed so much to 20th century America, to war efforts, to so on. We've just been an industrial behemoth, and it's just felt it's so important to document kind of the history of this area and everything, Northwest Indiana has contributed to the world.
Well, Joseph, people are going to leave it at that. It's a great way to give you an idea of what the history of Hammond, Indiana is all like. And you'll have to read the book to find out all the great details. And there's plenty in the book to learn about. And reading the book, which is entitled Lost Hammond, Indiana, it's published by Arcadia Publishing and the History Press. And the author of the book is Joseph Peet, who we, of course, recognize from his work with the Times of Northwest Indiana, which, of course, used to be known as the Hammond Times. If you have to have lived here long enough or been familiar with Northwest Indiana long enough to remember that, but it's all part of history, and this book is a great way to learn something that you may not have known about the history of Hammond, Indiana. And Joseph P., thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about your book that is out there now. You can buy it. Go online to Arcadia Publishing and find out more about it. Thank you very much for talking about it today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Demonstrations are flaring up across the country to protest the deaths of Black Americans at the hands of police. They're also calling attention to broader inequities and inequalities. And one of those areas, health disparities, kills Black Americans in massive numbers. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson and Carter Barrett report.
Black residents of Marion County, where Indianapolis is located, are more likely to be infected with COVID-19 than white residents. They are also more likely to suffer from diseases like diabetes and kidney failure.
There's nothing about Black residents in Indianapolis in particular makes them more susceptible to the coronavirus. What it is it's sort of a result of so many layers of inequity.
This is Matt Nowlin. He co-authored a new report from Savvy a program affiliated with the Polis Center at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis.
At the end of the day, these systemic inequities can be a life or death issue.
One result is a big difference in life expectancy. Researchers from SAVI and the Richard Fairbanks School of Public Health found a few years ago that people in a mostly white suburb lived to 83 years old on average. 15 miles south in downtown, where there are more minorities, the average was only 69. This pattern in Indianapolis holds true in cities across the Midwest and U.S. And though health issues aren't a focus of street protests, some experts say they contribute to the unrest.
We know that African-American, Latino patients, and other minority patients are more likely to have poor living conditions on average. They're more likely to have issues with food insecurity. They're more likely to have access to non-healthy diets.
That's Dr. Curtis Wright, CEO of Eskenazi Medical Group, the city's safety net hospital. Some patients, he says, might be unaware they are high risk because of poor access to health care.
There's known to be lack of trust in medical providers regarding medications, education about certain conditions, and some preventive measures.
The Indiana Minority Health Coalition has been involved in these issues for years. Here's Vice President of Public Policy, Tony Gillespie.
We're one of the states with the lowest public health investment in the country. Well, you know, you really can't adequately address public health if you don't address social justice issues and social determinants of health.
Social determinants are factors like unsafe housing, lack of transportation, or scarce grocery stores. They all contribute to health problems and make solutions even more complex.
I think when things become just like part of the landscape, then it becomes deprioritized. And nobody really pays attention to it, and it just becomes yet another issue that has to be addressed across the public health continuum.
Gillespie says the recent protests and outrage are in part a response to these historic inequalities.
I think those people, they are in the thick of it, so they know something is wrong. Do they attribute that to a public health issue? No, probably not. I think there are people who in public health don't necessarily make that connection.
But now many are asking what can be done. The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus is working to address disparities with COVID-19, and many local clinics offer special programming related to diabetes. The Minority Health Coalition wants the state to spend more money on health, and Wright, the Eskenazi CEO, sees a big opportunity in education. The American Cancer Society's Brian Hannon has lobbied lawmakers to make public health policy changes for years. He says change won't come easy.
We shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that this is a problem we can solve with one policy or with one conversation or with one campaign, and certainly not one legislative session or one budget cycle.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett reporting with Darian Benson.
On this week's Shelf Discovery, Kristen starts a new job with a walking disaster in Emma Hart's Catastrophe Queen.
Log into your computer and answer that phone call, because this week's discovery struggles to stay focused at work. Thanks for tuning into this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm Kristen Dreyer Kramer. Some people are born with grace and style. Others just seem to be an accident waiting to happen. And in the audio edition of Catastrophe Queen by author Emma Hart, a walking disaster stumbles her way into the life of her rich, successful new boss. The story starts a new job with accident-prone Mallory. After her apartment burns and she loses her job, she finds herself living with her parents and dealing with visiting family, desperate to get back out on her own. Fortunately, she finds the perfect job as the assistant to a high-end real estate agent. Or at least, it seems like the perfect job until she meets her new boss, Cameron Reed, and sees how young and good-looking he is. And she realizes that her job won't be as easy as she originally thought. Now, starting any new job can be nerve-wracking, but when you also have to worry about falling down and embarrassing yourself, or possibly falling for your handsome boss, it's even more so. And when Cameron repeatedly comes to Mallory's rescue, it leads to some serious complications in their working relationship. The rest of the story, of course, is pretty much as you'd expect, but the cute characters keep it entertaining. Mallory is a lovable train wreck who just can't help but get herself into trouble. Most of us know someone like Mallory, and her constant mishaps give the story its humor without going too far over the top. Of course, her meddling family and their constant questions and lack of a filter don't hurt either. Meanwhile, Cameron brings stability to the situation. The strong, responsible one who rarely trips over himself or spills coffee all over his desk. But although he's more even-keeled, the two balance each other out nicely. And even though, when you really think about it, the whole thing is based on an ill-advised and generally inappropriate relationship, the likable characters and their budding romance make for a fluffy but enjoyable read. But is it worth taking the job with this clumsy assistant? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say borrow it. Catastrophe Queen isn't unexpected or unforgettable, but it's light and fun. A cute story about a bumbling girl and the boss of her dreams. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. Catastrophe Queen by Emma Hart is 6 hours and 40 lovably bumbling minutes long and is available from Dreamscape Media. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com. And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
Dedicated to helping busy readers wade through the shelves and shelves of options to discover books that are worth their often limited reading time, Shelf Discovery can be heard on Thursdays here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, as Kristen Dreyer-Kramer offers listeners a brief look inside the pages of a new book. And that is it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on Monday's program, we'll have conversations with people such as Tammy Silverman with the Indiana Youth Institute, finding out more about changes that have happened in Indiana education in the age of coronavirus. We hope you'll join us.